This thing looks like it's going to poke me in the eye. Can I pull it down a little bit? Yeah, thank you very much. And it makes that sound. That's a lovely sound. Okay, hey everybody. I'm an alcoholic and I'm a member of the Downtown Dry Dock Prayer Meditation Group. We meet at 5:30, 5:45-ish, somewhere in there. And my sobriety date is December 24, 1989, and my name is Cindy. So, anyhow, so he says, knock him dead, and I'm thinking, no, I won't have nobody to talk to afterwards. So I don't know about that. I take things literally, but not so much. So I bought my owner's manual. I like to say that. If you don't have one, one can be issued for you. Some groups say, you know, our cost, your terms, and I say whatever it takes. You know, some people stealing from the libraries. I did not. I did. This is a newer one, but it has been purchased. So I didn't have to steal that. My other one is falling apart. You know, it has a big giant clip into it. And then some of the stories aren't in there because I was at a big book meeting. And I was reading some of the stories. I'm looking. I'm like, I don't have that one. What happened to that? It was an older version. And I didn't know that. And I also did doing a 12 in 12 meeting. And I was talking about the steps. And this was in another meeting. And one of the members had said, you know, you need to update that version. I said, well, it still works, so I'm going to stick with the version I have. But I did need this because I wanted to read some of the stories with the group that on Monday night that I go to. Okay, so I wrote myself some cue cards. You know, God let me entertain myself. I said, maybe I should write things down so I'll remember. God's like, yeah, go ahead and do that. Because that's, I get super afraid. And it doesn't matter. And I've spoken at conventions before. You know, I've been to awesome places, Kansas, if you can call that awesome. New Orleans, right? And, you know, Panama City. All kinds of really cool places. And it doesn't matter to me how many people are there. I'm still afraid. Because I want you to like me. And that's part of my illness, too, is that I really want you to like me. So then I felt like as I was talking a little bit more with the God of my understanding, God said, well, you're even afraid when you go speak at a detox and they're all looped up. So, you know, it doesn't matter, you know. You get worried, you know, when you're speaking with a sponsee one-on-one. It's such a privilege, even if I get to talk to one person about Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a privilege, and I don't want to mess it up. Not that I have the power to do that, but, you know, the disease tells me, you ain't got nothing to say. Sit down and shut up. So let's go back to a little bit. I'm going to be all over the place, and that's okay. That's where I am. So I did write one good cue card that said to thank the committee. Thank the committee. Thank you, committee. So that was a good cue card, so we can put that one away. Now, I'm not sure if I'm going to get through all the steps or not. I like to think that we can, but as I was hearing a couple of really strong shares the past couple of days, and the strong, when I say strong shares, when it resonates with me, and then I say, God, we're not going to talk about those things, are we? And God says, yes, we are. So I'm not sure, you know, if we're going to get through the steps, but we'll do the best we can. I bought tissues because a friend of mine says, you're not doing hormones, are you? And I said, shut up. And I'm just not going to do those. I'll just be vulnerable and cry. You know, we're on our way to, as they say, you know, we're trudging the happy road. And I said, yeah, you know, God's my driver and all that, but in the back seat is the disease. And it's the backseat driver, and it's always yamming at me about something. You ain't got nothing to say. Don't be going there. Keep your mouth shut. And that's what this disease wants us to do, is to keep our mouth shut. So we have to talk a lot. I'm from an awesome place in Maryland. You wouldn't know it if you got there. It's why, because there would be no reason for you to be there. I mean, it's all, you know, farmland. It's, you know, dirt. I was raised on a tobacco farm. You know, that's kind of interesting when if you think about it. It's really not, but if you think about being where I am today from where I was then, the math isn't, it doesn't sound right to me. It's like 2 and 2 are 5. So on that tobacco farm, if you have that habit, you are welcome. You know, I helped to contribute to that, and I feel bad about that, but You got to work your steps on that one too. That's all I know. It says about getting in here. It talks about getting all lit up, but lit up in many different ways. So everybody there drank. I never knew that there was a problem with alcohol because that's what I knew. So I don't know that I really judged it as anything other than it was there, morning, noon, and night. I'm a product of two alcoholic parents. When I talk about this, I know one of the reasons, too, that I get afraid and fearful because a guy in a home group that I had in Maryland, in Bel Air Big Book, his name was Joel, and he came in to speak, and he says, you know, my knees are knocking. You know, I'm afraid. And he said, that's because God's shaking the truth out of me. I'm like, well, I don't want none of that. But it's the truth. It's that fear that you're not going to like me. And what does it matter? I'm probably not going to see hardly any of you anyhow, but it matters. It really does matter. So getting back on that farm and knowing that that these alcoholic parents, I could not, there's no way I could have turned out any differently. I don't care how you, whatever kind of math, crazy math or computing you did, there was no way for me to turn out any differently. You know, I had said growing up, I'm not going to be like those people. But in essence, I had become them. There's no way that I could not be like them. There was nothing to do differently than to mimic who they were. And I didn't know that I was doing that. My parents tell me that, and my grandmother does too, that I'm the youngest of four children. There would have been five. The one before me, because they were all stair-stepped except for myself. So the one before me that didn't make it, I think, you know, I might not have shown up or whatever, I don't know, but here I am. So I was a child that they said, a baby that didn't thrive. And I couldn't take lights, sound. You know, I couldn't eat well, I couldn't do this. I could not do things. So what they did with me, because my mother said that, you know, there were other children at home and there was noise, you can't be there. So she sent me off with my grandmother from the hospital because it's quiet there. And my grandmother told me the care that she had given me, which we hear a lot that they did the best that they could, but it wasn't good enough. I've done the best that I could, but it wasn't good enough. So she would try to feed me and she would do the swaddling thing and put me in a dark room. And that was the treatment that I got. I learned like isolation really early on in that, but that's what I got. And then later I had come to my mind that children that don't thrive, children that can't take light and sound, and babies that, you know, when they get here, those are addicted babies. And I had to sit with that for a little bit because the rest of them were fine. She took them home. There was no problem with them. But I was one of the addicted ones. There was something wrong with me. So my mother, you know, she had to chase her addiction, which was alcohol, and my father. And my father had, you know, his lovely alcoholism to deal with, too. And they would just leave us, children, just leave. And then I later learned to say that it was abandonment and neglect. They had to take care of their disease. I know that today. Then I didn't know that. I didn't understand, like, what's the problem? You know, why aren't they here? And there's no food. The electric would be cut off because she forgot to pay. There's no phone. And what are we going to do? So I had to learn at an early age how to really take care of myself. I would get afraid. I was the youngest one, and by the time my siblings went off to school, I'm there by myself. And I don't know what to do. So my mother sends one of her drunk brothers. I've since heard somebody say that they were their drunkles. I love that. That's right. They're my drunkles. And out of the two of those uncles, one would, you know, kind of be like the tag team. And they're drunked up, and they'd say, come on, get in the car. And I learned drunk talk really early. When other children were learning their ABCs and, you know, and being read to things, I was learning how to take cigarettes out of drunks' hands and putting them out, and how not to get hit, how not to get left at the bar. My diet consisted of, at the bars, I would have ice cream. I love those chocolate eclairs. They're my favorite. Beer nuts and Coca-Cola. And I was, to me, that was, I got something as opposed to nothing. And then I would have nickels because then I could play the slot machine. And back then, that was just what it is. I used to say, well, it was okay. It was never okay. It's just how it was. It was, that was what we did. So I remember with these drunkles, I would watch them. I would learn how to watch really closely. And this is where other things, hypervigilance would come in. But I would watch them very closely to where they would get to that place. And I knew that it was time to probably get in the car because I might get left behind. Always afraid of being abandoned. So I would get in the car, and then, you know, when they would come in, I would be in the back. And this was those big, big cars, really big, giant cars, like tanks or whatever. And I remember kind of rolling in the back seat, boop, 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 as they were, because they're driving all over the place. They're drunk driving. So I'm used to drunk drivers. You know, I get that. I understand that part. And then, you know, we would get home. And we would go inside, and then he would sit in a chair, and he would light up a cigarette, and he would drink his Black Label. And by like that, ugh, stuff is nasty. And I would watch him slowly nod out and pass out, and I would watch that cigarette burning down his hand, to his hand. And I thought to myself, should I try to wake him up and deal with the violence, or should I sit here and panic and wonder what? If the house is going to burn down. Those were the decisions I had to make, where other kids were like peanut butter jelly or bologna. After a while, when my mother, if people would always ask me to, where's your mother? I hated that question. I don't know where she is. She's wherever she is. She's where she is. I don't know. But I would feel that shame of her not being there. And then she would pass me on to somebody else, and it would be the same scenario, the drunk. I understood drunks. I knew how to talk their language. So my father he was a very violent drunk. My mother was the codependent one, tried to drink along behind him. And she told me one day, she was trying to make up something, I don't know. I asked her where the old man was. And when I say the old man, we do that. That was a loving thing that we would say to him. I don't know why. We'd always say, where's the old man? And one day, I don't know why she would say this. She says, oh, he's the police have him. Well, I just broke down and started crying. I'm like, oh, my God, the police have him. This is terrible. We got to go get him. Codependence. We got to go get him. She said, no, I'm just kidding. They're not there. I said, well, then where is he? She said, he's on a safari. I said, safari? I'm thinking Doctari now. I'm like, man, he's out there. He's got this fancy hat on, and, you know, he's riding in a Jeep. This stuff's happening. I want to go, too. I told Mom, I said, well, I want to go. And she said, honey, one day you'll go on your safari too. She was right. So after a time, you know, as time's going on and I'm still into the, you know, worrying about drunks and whatnot and watching them, I took a drink. And some people say, oh, it was this wonderful feeling of, you know, ecstasy. And it's like, oh, it was great. I just remembered it being that there was a thought that came in my mind. Because I stopped worrying for a moment. And I thought, this is where they're going. This is the safari they're talking about. This is where they go. Because they're not dealing with their situations at home. This is where they go. And I thought, I'm going to go there as much as I can. And I did. From that point on, I went and I drank as much as I could. It was not anything in my home that was you would get in trouble for. There was no getting in trouble for smoking cigarettes. Well, you know what? You're keeping up the price of tobacco, and we need that. We need you as a customer. There was none of that, you know, don't you think you're drinking too much? They're focused on their own drinking. When I really started to kick in the gear as a teenager in drinking, I would be at certain bars. I'm not supposed to be at bars, you know, I'm like, this is between the age of 14 and 16 where I really had some issues. And I remember just, you know, my father would be in the front area of a bar, and I would be at the pool table. And some of my friends would come back and say, hey, man, your old man's at the bar. And I'd look and I'd say, he ain't going to look at me. He ain't not going to know I'm here. If he does, he ain't not going to know who I am anyhow. So who cares? But I'd be watching him. You know, I would be watching this guy and thinking, if he starts to make it this way, I've got an exit that way. I always had the exit. And I would go out the back and just go someplace else. I was driving with some friends one night, and I saw my father walking on the street, and he's staggering and whatnot. And these friends like, "Hey, isn't that your old man?" I was like, "No, yeah, it is. We should stop him. I was like, no, don't stop him. I'm begging him. Please don't stop. He's going to ruin everything. You get him in here, he's going to ruin it all. And so we just kept going. And I looked back, and the guilt, you know, of not taking care of him was just horrendous. You know, I'm like, God, he's ruining my high, and he ain't even in here. But I thought that whole night, I was like, he could be in the ditch, passed out somewhere or whatever. But by the time I finally got home, he was there. He always shows up, just like drunks. We're going to show up. We had this blizzard one time. No, we had a lot of blizzards, but this one in particular that people get the T-shirt, I survived the blizzard of 70, ever what. He was in the bar, and he just kept drinking. They couldn't get him out. So they locked him in there. Lucky, right? This guy. So he sleeps on the pool table. He had a grand time. It was wonderful. And I'm asking Mom, I'm like, where's the old man? She said, they locked him up in the bar. He's all right. So a couple of days later, he shows up. But these are the things, this is my lifestyle. This is what we do. We don't do anything healthy. We don't do anything together as a family. It's a divide and conquer thing. And, you know, I mean, I would drink and do extracurricular activities with my siblings, but there was no camaraderie there. There was none of that family building orientation. So I'm about 16, and I go to this keg party. I'm trying to get myself qualified. I'll get into the steps here in a minute. But I'm at this keg party, and we're just very high-class keg party. You know, we're drinking out of the mason jars, you know, because we're so cool. And I'm doing some other extracurricular activities on the side. And all of a sudden, I feel this pain, this shooting pain in my chest. I'm like, oh, man, that's smart. Or slow down a little bit, right? And then it got even worse. And I thought, I better go home. So I'm driving drunk home, smoking a cigarette, and thinking, dang, man, this feels bad. I even got hold of something bad. That's what happened. And I thought, well, I'll just get home, and I'll sleep it off, and it'll be all right. So this is the one time I get home, and people are there. I'm like, what kind of luck is that? My mother couldn't focus on my father at the time, so she had to turn her focus on me the one time. Well, what's wrong? I'm holding my chest, nothing. I'm like, I'm just going to go to bed. The next thing I knew, the rescue squad's there, the police are there, because they come hand in hand. Everybody's there, what's going on? I'm like, I don't know, just let me sleep it off. So I go to the hospital. They ask you the questions. Have you been drinking? No. You know, no, absolutely not. I'm not. I don't want to get in trouble, right? And stupid thinking. Do you smoke cigarettes? No. You know, but they never asked about the other curricular things that I did. So what had happened was, one of the extracurricular activities I was doing made a lung collapse. So they put a tube down in there. I know, it was really gross. So as I'm watching this and I'm looking at this device that they have, it's a gallon jug, and you can see the breathing. It goes up and down, and I thought, man, that would make a great bong, right? It's my thinking. So when I'm leaving, and after they take the tube out, you know, I'm leaving, I said, hey, you mind if I take that with me? And he's like, what are you going to do with that? It's a science project. Seems reasonable. Well, that as soon as I got home, we made a bong out of that and did some more extracurricular things. A few years later, it happened on the left side, and I go to the hospital. I know what this feeling is now. So I go there and I get the tube down in there, and the doctor says, you know, you keep doing this to yourself, and they're both going to go down. You're going to die, you know. What about this? I'm not afraid of dying. It's my living that I've got a problem with. No one ever asked me if I had a problem with alcohol. It was like this huge, like Harry Potter cloak or something. I don't know, but no one asked me if I had a problem with alcohol. So I kept drinking. I kept showing up at the places that I didn't need to show up at. So fast forward, then I get fortunate enough to meet the man of my dreams. Yay. He shows up, and we're drinking buddies. It's great. It's just wonderful. And then it's not so wonderful after a while, because then we're fussing with one another. He's picking me up at bars, and because he's gone home because he's going to work the next day or whatever he's going to do. But They've taken my keys. Now they call him to come pick me up. And I'm a puker. You know, I needed to put that in there. I really am. I love shoes, but they don't last with me if I'm drinking. Right? So my husband says, nothing says love than holding your wife's hair while she throws up on the side of the road or whatever, and the splashing, you know, the splashing. Ugh. Yeah, it does. I'm sorry, that's where I am. So this is the kind of love that we have, right? It's wonderful. We're helping one another out here. He's holding my hair. He's, you know, I remember him throwing me over his shoulder and taking me and putting me in the car, and I'm screaming at him like, hey, what are you doing? And then I had some work stuff in the trunk, and he's like, it felt like he was all over the road, and I could hear the monitor in the back going, do-do-do-do-do-do, back and forth. And we would fuss and fight until the next night. It would happen all over again, throwing up, throwing up, throwing up. My father, and after I learned this after a while, my father would drink until he physically couldn't ingest anymore, and he's throwing up blood. And he's got to get put into, as they would say, the jitter joint or the dry cleaners. And my mother would have, my second oldest brother would be the one to have him committed, Baker Act him and whatnot. She wouldn't do that. And then when he would come out, she would point at that one. He did it. That's the love. So so anyhow, so my husband and I, we continue to drink and we have a wonderful, lovely time. And we go to this wedding. It's a lovely wedding. Without us, it would have probably been even lovelier. And it was in New Jersey. I'm coming up to the end of my drinking, which is a good thing. So it was in New Jersey, and there was a cocktail party before the service, the wedding, and then there was another party prior to that. So we went to both of those places. So we're lit up in the church, and as we come out, then they have some more cocktails before the reception. It's great. I'm loving this. So we get to the reception, and it's just a lovely, lovely place. But my husband, he's taking people upstairs to our room, and their wives are upset with me because he's going to do extracurricular activities. And I'm just having a blast. Drinks are free, and I don't know what their problem is. I said, well, go on up there with him. He's probably got plenty. Go ahead. This is how the evening goes. So then he comes back down and decides that they don't have the beer that he wants to have. He wants a Budweiser, and we're off to find a Budweiser in this place. So we go into this other wedding. I don't know this is at the time. And we get the Budweisers, and he says, see, honey, here. And I'm trying to listen to people. I'm a loud person when I drink, because I think somehow you've suddenly gone deaf. And I'm a loud person, and I'm like, I don't understand what they're talking about. And he's like, shh. And I listen a little bit more. I was like, well, what are they saying? And I'm looking at them as they're talking, and I don't know what they're talking about. Well, it was a Polish wedding. And they were speaking Polish. And he's like, shut up, you're going to get us kicked out of here. So we had to leave. So we get back to the wedding we're supposed to be at, and we got Budweiser's like, hey, where'd you get the Budweiser's? You know, we're out down there. It's great. So towards the end of the evening, we're needing a designated elevator operator. I mean, it's just ugly. It's just ugly. And I'm having two drinks. I'm always a two-fisted drinker in case this one is going, I've got my backup plan. And I'm walking down the hall, and I can feel this wine just all sloshing all over the place. And it was an ugly night. But the next morning, I felt like God spoke to me. He's like, this is enough of this. You're not going to be doing this anymore. I was like, all right, I'm done. I'm not going to do it anymore. So on the way home, he's like, hey, you want a little some of this? I was like, no, I'm done. And he laughed. He thought this was funny. He said, I've heard that before. Just take it. I'm like, no, I'm done. This was in October. And I felt pretty good about my decision for a little bit. And then came another weekend where I had to do this all over again. Only this was the one that really sealed the deal. And this is the part of my story that he doesn't like. So we go to, I don't even remember where it was. I don't remember how I got home. I don't remember that we had our son. I don't remember if we had a babysitter. I don't remember if we picked him up or if the babysitter was there. I don't remember none of that. But the next morning, my son is shaking me, and I'm mad at him, you know, because I'm coming to him like, what do you want? He says, I'm hungry, Mama. And it was only a few seconds, but in my mind it took forever, because I started to think, he's hungry. What's going on here? What time is it? And then I start putting a couple of pieces together. I'm like, how did we get here? How did he get here? Is the door locked? Was this extracurricular activity stuff left out? What happened? And I thought he could have got on the stove, tried to cut that on. He could have got a knife. He could have got anything. He could have gone outside. And I started feeling really bad. I'm like, God almighty, I can't do this no more. And I look over, and he's passed out. He's just gone. He hadn't heard the first thing going on. And I thought to myself, if something happens to me, that's all he's got, and that ain't much. And that's a terrible part of the story, but it's my truth. And I said, God, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to live like this anymore. And something changed again. You know, I saw the light again. So I stayed dry until, like, Christmas Eve comes up. And there's something spicy I'm eating. And I start to reach for that Budweiser. And I looked at that, and I looked at my husband. And I said, I wasn't going to do that. And I put that down. I said, God, help me. That was the last drink I had. Was in December 24, 1989. It has nothing to do with Christmas Eve. People are like, how could you get sober on Christmas Eve? Have nothing to do with that. When you're done, you're done. It doesn't matter if it's Tuesday. You're done. If you've had enough, you're done. So for the next little over a year, my lovely spouse would try to help me to get to drink. It was tough. So when I hear people say, I can't, and this is no offense to nobody, all right? It's just my truth, all right? They say, I can't get sober because my husband or my wife drinks, and I can't get sober in that house. And I said, that's bull crap. You know, I have done it. It's not comfortable, but you can do it. If you want to stay sober, you'll do it. And fortunately, you know, obviously I'm here. That part had a happy ending, but I had a plan. I'm glad I get to my plan now. Okay, so I hope everybody thinks I'm powerless at this point. So I have a plan how I'm not going to drink. Everybody gets a plan. My plan was really awesome. Now, my son, you know, he's like 3, almost 4 at this time. All I have to do is stay sober for the next 14 years, not drink. And because I don't want to be like my people, right? If I can just not do that for 14 years, when he graduates, I'm going to stop at the liquor store and pick up my Southern Comfort. It doesn't bring comfort, but I'm going to have it. And I'm going to get a carton of cigarettes. And if that other extracurricular activity is around, I'm going to do that too. I'm going to blow it out. So that was my plan. So I'm like, now how am I going to do this for 14 years? By that time, my father had gotten into Alcoholics Anonymous. That's another lovely story. We're sitting around the table all lit up, and it's always somebody's turn to go pick up the old man. And my mother says, you know, go pick up your old man at the bar. It's time for somebody to go pick him up. I said, I did it yesterday. It's her turn. So we're back and forth bickering who's going to pick up the old man. And the telephone rings. And she's mad. She's like, nobody's got to pick him up now. The police have him. I'm like, yeah. It's a night of peace. That's what I'm talking about. And he went. It was bad for him. You know, he wasn't going anywhere. He just had the keys and the ignition. He said, I was just going to sleep it off for a little bit. Too bad. You out. So he goes to jail. He wasn't going on a safari that time. Believe that. So he gets himself in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he comes home. He's, you know, Mr. Savior of whatever, I don't know. But he tells me, I want you to go meet Bert. I'm like, Bert? Who the hell's Bert, you know? Bert's my sponsor. I'm like, I'm thinking, you know, race car drive and stuff. Your sponsor, what are you into now, right? He's an Alcoholics Anonymous. I was like, well, good for you. So he says, no, I really need you to do this. And he's never asked me to do anything. I was like, well, all right, I'll go. So I go to see Bert. Bert's like 1,000 years old. You know, he sponsored Noah and Mary Magdalene, you know. That's how old Bert was. Bert was plenty old. So Bert's, he's telling me about what the old man's going to be going through. And I'm thinking, like, I care. You know, he's got to go to court, and he's got to do it. Well, you paid it. You know, you're going to play, you got to pay. He says, this is what I want you to do. Well, now it's turned. The tables have turned. He said, I want you to go to Al-Anon. I'm like, Al-Anon. He said, after you go to Al-Anon, I want you to promptly go to AA. I'm like, all right, see ya. So I'm codependent, and I do it. You know, I go to Al-Anon so I can say I did it. They said, you didn't cause it. Check. Can't control it. Check. And you can't cure it. Check. I'm out. So I can say I win. And then they said, now you got to go to AA. I'm like, oh, dear God, you know, there's more. So I went a couple of times. I'm like, all right, that's nice. I see what you're going through. Have fun with that, and I'm out. Well, then he started taking my inventory. Now, I know that now is the inventory. I didn't know it then. I just felt then it's like, shut your mouth, you know. You're messing with my high again. He said, you know, people that plan their drinks are considered alcoholic. And I'm like thinking, you should have better planned your stuff. You wouldn't be going to those meetings, and you wouldn't have got picked up. You got to plan a little bit better. And I would take my son over there. I'm like, look, you know, I'm going out and this, that, and the other. I was like, look, can the boy stay or not? Yeah, he can stay. But I'm telling you, you got the signs of alcoholism. I'm like, all right, then. So back to my plan. You know, I'm hearing an old man's voice in the back for the first time in my mind. I couldn't stand him my whole life. And now I'm hearing him in my head, and I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings because I know that that's where the answer is. So I go to this meeting. It's the Lunch Bunch. It's at a Holiday Inn, and they have like a little food area. You know, you order the food, and you know, I would show up and I would, you know, try to eat something and hear. I wasn't really hearing anything, but I was going because the old man could stay sober. I could probably do it too for 14 years, and he was only sober that time maybe 2 years, but that was more than what I ever had. So I would try to leave before the prayer, and then, of course, you know how they do. They grab hold of you, and they're like, where are you going? I'm out. Let's go out and have coffee. I'm like, God, isn't that what we just did? What are we going to do? We're talking. I said, didn't we just do that too? Well, yeah, we'll get to know one another. I said, I don't want to get to know you. Well, do you want some numbers? Like, did I ask? I'm like, you got me wrong with this thing. I'm not here to make friends. I only got to do this for 14 years, and I could see their lap. I'm like, I only got to do this for 14 years, so I'm not staying to be friendly and to have you in my life. I'm only here to try to stay sober to get past this 14 years. And they're like, okay, dear, keep coming back. So my plan started to fail a little bit because now I get pregnant with my second child. I'm like, oh, God, now I got to add 18 more years to, you know, 14 sounded good. Now it's 18. I'm like, dang. Well, my husband then gets picked up for going to a Grateful Dead concert, and I asked him my codependent way, please don't come home. Stay with your brother in that area because you know how you are. I'm all right. I might stay. Well, I get that call, you know, 2, 3 in the morning. It's the police department, and they've got him picked up. And I'm like, I bet you it was at White Marsh. He always gets picked up at White Marsh. Why did he have to drive that way? And the police are asking me, they said, ma'am, have you been drinking? I said, no, but I need one. You know, and I thought, well, don't say that. Don't say it. Everything is okay. So I'm like, yeah, I'll come and get him. If I had had more Al-Anon, I would not have gone. That's terrible, but I would not have gone. I would have said, you can find your own way home. I'm going back to bed. Or I probably wouldn't have even answered the phone. I'm good in Al-Anon now. So I get my son together. And it's cold. It's February. It's flipping cold in Maryland. I hated Maryland anyhow because it's so cold and couldn't drink. So I get him in the car, and all the way there, I'm just like in my head, I'm rehearsing. I'm going to say this, and I'm going to say that, and da 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 da. And he gets to go out and drink, and I don't, and I need one, and on and on and on. My mind went. I pull up to this area, and I see him in this big window, and I see that look. And everything left. And I was like, that's enough. He's going to beat himself up enough. I don't need to do anything. And he gets in the car, and he's, you know, he's pretty remorseful. He says, well, aren't you going to say something? Hit me or something. I'm like, nah, I'm out. You've done enough. So we go through that. We grow through that, and we get to court for him. And this is where I've come to love sponsorship. And by that time, I had no sponsorship. I had nothing. I got my plan. Remember my plan, and I'm sticking to the plan. I'm not getting to know you people because I don't like you. So we go to the court, and he's probably going to maybe go away for a while. So we take his sponsor Ralph with us. God bless Ralph. We wait our turn, and we go up, and then the judge says, "Anybody here with you?" And he says, "Yeah, I got my wife and my sponsor." And I stood up, and I'm like. Pregnant, I'm big. I'm big. And he's like, sit down and do not have that baby in this courtroom. So then he talks to his sponsor for a little bit and just talks about the step work, and I'm listening to Ralph talk about, yeah, he's doing really good, and he's on this four step. I'm like, yeah, I remember him talking to me about this stupid four step. So when we get back out in the car, fortunately, he doesn't have to go to jail. We get back out in the car, and Ralph has this money, and I'm telling part of his story, but it's part of mine too. Ralph had all of his savings in his pocket in case he was going to go to jail to help to bail him out. I was like, that was love. I saw that was the love of Alcoholics Anonymous that I saw, because he was really, truly concerned with his well-being. And after that, when we started going to meetings together, I mean, different meetings, and he would say, hey, you got a sponsor? You got a sponsor? You got a sponsor? And you know how we are, right? You got a sponsor? And so I got a sponsor. You know, here's what I did. I told God. I love when I tell God stuff, right? I tell God, I'm like, all right, I'm going to test you out. We're going to road test this thing. I said, all right, God, John's bothering me about a sponsor. Other people are bothering me about a sponsor. So I tell you what, I need a sponsor, but I'm not going to ask. Did you know that lady, Rita? I like her. She's nice. If you want me to have a sponsor, you have her ask me. Right? And I'm like, then I'll know. Not only will I know, so I'm double testing now. Not only will I know you are real, but that you want me to have the sponsor, right? I'm covered, baby. I'm covered. So I go to my Wednesday meeting, and I'm like, ah, la, 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 la. And Rita comes up. She says, I've been thinking. I'm like, okay. She said, why don't I be your sponsor? You know, I look at her, right? And I'm like, oh, my God. And she's like, what? And I was like, now, I'm not going to tell you this. I'm not ready to tell you this. I'll be tell you another time. But that was just, to me, I was like, God, it's real. You know, and then after a while, the disease says, it's just a coincidence. No, but I asked, tell her, ask me to respond. It's a coincidence. So we start to work on the steps right away. And I have this four step that I'm working on, and he gets to go out of town, you know, on his business, and I pull out from under the bed and put the dust off of it, and I'm writing. And I get this done, and now I've got to go to her, the four step. And we have to talk about it. Rita was Al-Anon. She was not Alcoholics Anonymous. Her sponsor, Allie, was Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's Allie took her through the steps of AA, because back then, it's just there wasn't really anything there. I mean, we're talking, she probably co-sponsored Mary Magdalene. But so I'm showing up at my fifth step, and I start to tell her a few things about, going to jail and whatnot. And she's like, oh, wait. What were you doing? I said, well, I just told you what had happened. And she said, were you drinking? I said, maybe a little bit. She's like, okay, proceed. So I go on to the next thing on my list. And she's, why'd you go to jail then? I'm like, oh, just circumstances. She said, were you drinking then? I said, maybe a little bit. Finally, by the third time, she hollers for her husband, Al, get in here. And Al's Alcoholics Anonymous. And she starts to tell him, I was like, hey, wait a minute, this is between you and me. She says, not anymore, it's not. You're bringing in alcohol. I'm not an alcoholic sponsor. You need an alcoholic sponsor. So she said, you talk to Al about this. You got a problem, you talk to Al. So I talked to Al for quite a while, and they kind of tag teamed me until I could get another sponsor. And that's how it worked. I had to go back several times in my fifth step because I didn't trust her. And I would say, this is what happened. And she's like, okay, you know how we get into the bottom of the work? I go, okay, you sure? You haven't left anything out, right? And I'm like, no, I'm good this time. All right. And so we would go on, and then a week later, I'd be like, oh, can I come over? She's like, what is it now? I said, I got one more thing. And she's like, okay. And we did this a bunch of times till she finally said, when are you going to give it up? And I would have to tell her those things that, I wasn't supposed to talk about. I wasn't supposed to tell anybody about what happened. And I thought, if I tell her, she's going to think I'm dirty or whatever. But she's not going to like me anymore, and it's going to get bad. And that's not at all, obviously, what happened. And then we prayed about it for a while, and I was able to say, this is what happened in my life. And it's all good today. I know that. So when I have sponsees that give me their fist up, I say, well, let me tell you about mine first. And I tell them what happened. And then I hear theirs, and they get to the end. I said, now remember what I said. is this the, this all you got? Yeah, this is it. And I'm like, no, it ain't. I know that. No, it's not. So we go through 5, 6, 7, and 8, and we get through the steps. I think I'm running kind of out of time or something like that. I want to get through the steps. So we get to step 10, you know, continuing to take that personal inventory. Did you give me a sign? He gave me the sign, and it was a good sign. So we do the personal inventory every day, and I call her up, and I say, you know, what, you know, so another lady says, I'm singing the hymns, you know, him did this and him did that, and you don't understand. And I said, he doesn't even know how to buy Christmas presents. He bought me this whatever tacky thing, and I said, really? She said, I'll talk to him. I loved it. I always loved when Al would talk to John or Ralph, because I knew I was going to get my way then. Stick Al on them, Rita and Al and Ralph. So that did the personal inventory every day, and I would be complaining about him. She said, you know, I love John. She said, but I've about heard all I'm going to hear. I want to hear some more about you. What's behind that smoke screen? And we would do the gratitude list of, you know, let's do this gratitude list of John. I was like, I don't see nothing today. He's just aggravated me. She said, did he go to work? I said, yeah, but you don't understand. You know, did he shut the door on the way out? She said, he slammed it. She said, but he shut it, didn't he? And we would build this gratitude list until finally I didn't have to tell her about him anymore. It became more and more about me. Step 11 has been my favorite step of all, because that's the time I get to sit still with the God of my understanding. I get to talk to God, and God has changed so many times. And I've really talked to people about God, because God has changed to be from a person to this thing in the sky to, for me, it's my literature. It's my meeting. It's hearing you talk and share your experience, strength, and hope. That's the God of my understanding today. And that changed from way, way back to now. And I'm pleased with that. I love going to my Friday night meeting, because that's what we do. We meditate, and we have people that will come into that group, because there's another one that's happening at the same time, and they say, oh, is this the downtown dry dock? And he's like, yeah, this is the meditation group. And they're like, okay, bye. And they leave because they're scared. I don't know what they're scared of, but, you know, we're saving a seat for them in there too. So anybody can lead the group to any kind of meditation, and we get so much out of it, though. I get so much closer to God and hearing other people and their version of God, and it's a wonderful thing for me. And then step 12, there was a word thrown in there that has taken me a while. So it's been the last 2 years, I think, that I've noticed that this word that's put in there. It said that it was the word try. We try to carry this message. Because I would get on myself, I'm like, try, I don't understand with that. Because I would say, well, that one didn't make it. I had one call me the other night because she couldn't sleep. She said, well, I've been drinking vodka at night, you know, to help me to sleep. And I'm like, ugh, that ain't it. And I was on myself about, well, how did I drop the ball with her? What went wrong? Why couldn't she stay sober? Because I forgot it was that word in there. It says, we try. We're not responsible. You know, we take that message. So my codependency says, you know, you got to get this person sober. And then I can hear my mother back, go pick your old man up. I've got so much work to do in that. And I'm so fortunate that there's a lot of time that I get to do that, and that God shows me those words of try and to gently remind me that I'm not responsible for another person's sobriety or well-being. I am responsible for myself. And when I take care of myself first, then I have something for you. No, I wasn't taught that in my growing up years. I was taught that everybody else came first and you are last. So coming from that person, you know, that I had all these lovely cards made up, but coming from this tobacco farm to being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's just, I mean, you can't make this stuff up. Because I had no idea the drunks, there's so many drunk people in my life, and the things that I was taught to do is to not take care of myself. And then I come in here, and you guys take care of me. I've had 3 children. You guys have raised 3 children. You've kept me married for over 30 years. You know, you've kept me sober for over 28 years. When people have that, when we tell about the joys of our grown children now and the things that they've done, we give the gratitude back to you, because if I didn't have you, none of that stuff would have happened. I'm getting ready to be a grandmother. I'm way too young, but it's okay. I'm going to be a grandmother, and I'm so super excited about that. You know, my son calls me and tells me things, and if I were drinking, he would not have anything to do with me. Or, you know, I wouldn't even be here. I'd be dead. One of the two, but I wouldn't be able to participate in that. And that's because of you. You let me answer that phone when he calls and says, "Hey, Mama, it's going to be a boy." And I'm just, I can't wait to just to hold on to him. And, you know, none of my children have had to go through Alcoholics Anonymous. They know Alcoholics Anonymous. They know it's here if they need some help. They know Al-Anon is there. They know ACA is there. They know everything is there to help them. And I keep saying it doesn't get any better than that, but it does. Every day, it just gets better and better. And another person had told me is that, and you hear this too, Cowboy Chris would always say, you know, if nobody's told you today that they love you, let me be the first one, and I truly do love you, and thank you so much.